Tereo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout. Although you're basically having me today, Marianne is enjoying the heat and the tennis in Melbourne. But I've got some wonderful books and the chance to attend a very special, I hesitate to use the word unique, it's overused and not always used properly, but I think in this case we could almost use it. It's the Readers and Writers Festival in Akaroa, which is happening in early March. I will be talking with Marie Connolly, who's chair of the board and has put the program together. I'm also talking with a wonderful new writer called John Prinz, who's a short story writer. I really rate his work, and he has just had his first collection of short stories published by Otago University Press. But first, let's listen to Kate Coughlan. Kate is a long-time journalist and editor of such publications as New Zealand House and Garden and New Zealand Life and Leisure. But she, along with others, has put together a really stunning, inspiring, aspirational book called New Zealand Rustic. Kate Coughlan has had a long and stellar career as a journalist and magazine editor of publications such as New Zealand House and Garden and New Zealand Life and Leisure. She's been at the forefront, really, of promoting good design, sustainable living and practices, and just sheer beauty in our interior and exterior surroundings. So it's really no surprise that her latest venture is a stunning book, New Zealand Rustic, Creating a Home Inspired by Nature. She's joined in this venture with our photographer Tessa Crisp and art director Yolanta Waldendorp. And I think publisher Malcolm Ruff, who has one of the outstanding properties in this book, Kate.
Yes, and Malcolm is a newcomer to publishing, but a man with a very good eye and a strong interest in what makes a home soulful, in the nicest way, soulful, you know, a home with spirit and soul and interest. And he is, in fact, a farmer, retired farmer from the Mahia Peninsula, but became very interested in homes and with a sort of sustainable ethos and an interest in how things appeal to people on many levels and how they nurture people. You know, homes aren't always that way, to be honest. Sometimes one goes into a house and feels, oh, where can I sit? Am I allowed to sit down? But the houses that he wanted us to focus on in this book are all the kind of homes where you would walk in and immediately feel comfortable to throw yourself into a sofa and begin a conversation.
Yes, I wondered what your definition or his, because I guess it's his as well as yours, what your definition of New Zealand rustic is. I think you've started articulating it there, but you may want to add to that.
Things that come into play when people are thinking about their homes. And at the moment, there is a strong interest in sustainability, in recycling or reuse of materials and items. And there's also a strong pushback against highly manufactured items. So being surrounded by things that come more closely from the natural world, I think, was where he wanted us to start looking. Initially, he was inspired by the Scandi rustic ethos and found himself in bookshops looking into books that called themselves Scandi Rustic. And he came to me because he knew I was editing or had been editing these sorts of magazines for a long time and said, is there a New Zealand rustic book? And I said, there isn't, no, that I'm aware of. So he said, well, why don't we create one? Which was a very exciting and a lovely project. And so we came up with many options for him, and he did have the final say. Yolanta, the wonderful art director, with whom I've worked for well over 25 years, she worked really hard to make sure he had a selection that was equal from both islands and a mixture of modern and refurbished and new build. So, yeah, he had a strong idea about what spoke to him and what was interesting, I think. So we've come up with six homes, three in the north and three in the south, which represent quite different styles of decor and quite different approaches to architecture and design.
I have to say, you might not be surprised, that one of my favourites is definitely the Raggedy Range one, which is a modern build. It's very simple. It's rammed earth. It sits in the landscape so well, and it was the one that I probably immediately thought, oh, I could live in that.
It is a wonderful house. The land is very extreme. It's limestone outcrops, so quite significant tors, I think the formal name is, of limestone rising up out of quite rough land. It's covered in a lovely thyme, which is gorgeous to walk on and smell, and some briar rose bushes. And it's a site of old gold mining remains from the 19th century. And the people who designed that house, they're both designers, one landscape and one graphic. And they had a strong passion for trying to make the house of the land. So it's a rammed earth house, which has sort of risen up out of this very dramatic landscape to sit very securely in the landscape. Yes, I think that land is very important and special to me because actually, funnily enough, Warren, I used to own that land. I lived in a caravan for, I don't know, 10 years, thinking about what kind of a house to build. And so I know that land very well, and I know how windy it can get in that environment. And that house that they've built is a remarkable achievement and a remarkable bulwark against what the elements can throw at you on that particular site.
Yeah, it's got a calmness. It's you know, very modern in many respects, but the way that they've, as all these houses have, the way they have put pieces into the spaces is incredibly, I was going to say appealing, but I think that is probably the right way, the right word.
Because they've got such a strong design ethos,
yes,
both of them, and
yeah,
they're interested in how things work together as small, still life.
Mm.
So you can have a look at the side of their sofa, for example, and there's this beautiful piece of timber that came from some local place, and there's a 1980s owl sitting on top of it, base lamp, which is a very, in the wrong house it would look odd, but it looks very fantastic there because, you know, they've got that ability to think of the land and of the place and of the time and something with character.
Yes. As I'm looking through this, I think what a treasure it must be to have access to an old farm or old buildings, old industrial sites, to be able to pick and choose, you know, random bits to complement and put into your house and into your garden.
Yes, and those create stories in your house, and they bring memories in, and I think they make a home much more alive. in Malcolm's own house, which is on the Mahia Peninsula, he has a wonderful big veranda that goes around three sides of the villa. And on one wall of the villa, the veranda wall, above the big cane wood boxes, he has a collection of old bottles, which he, over the years, collected from various settlements that were abandoned, and they were throughout his farm. It was adjacent to the site of the now unused railway line between Gisborne and Hawke's Bay. And whilst that railway line was being built, there were various small townships or workmen's camps, really, along that route. And he would find the remains of people's lives. And he thought they were interesting, and he would bring home a bottle or two bottles or whatever. So he's got quite a magnificent collection. And I think that's just so interesting, isn't it, to have something that came from your farm that speaks to the history of your region, that reminds you that men lost their lives putting in that railway line, and now it's disused. Mm. How life changes and goes on.
Yeah, and
I think that's why the book is speaking to people, because it has multiple facets and touch points for a good, interesting life.
Well, we didn't need to talk about Jim O'Dillon and his Rumble Bay house. I met him briefly once on a boat in the Sounds. And then, of course, used to call in to the cafe at Kikaringu, which he designed for his sister and her husband. So, you know, that's out on, again, a rugged coast, battered by winds, dry, stony, and he made that house himself pretty well.
He did. He was a brilliant man, and he could turn his hand pretty much to anything. He just had a passion for design. He called himself a farmer who kind of tinkered with things, but he really was, even though he wasn't formally trained as an architect, he was a brilliant architectural designer. And that house is an absolute joy to go into. It really is. It feels like you're in a cocoon, but you're connected with nature. There are no sharp angles, no, he didn't really believe in 45 degrees. You know, he really wanted to build with the kind of curves that worked for the land. And that's how he built that house, with bent chicken wire covered in concrete. Sounds terrible, but it is an exquisitely beautiful house.
Oh, yes. And plastered and painted white inside, outside the concrete's been left to weather, and the landscape, just using tussocks, grasses, nyos, cabbage trees, all the things that would grow there naturally, but they've all been artfully put together, haven't they?
Yes, his daughter, the lovely Michael, told me that Jim really liked to garden with a bobcat. And if the plants couldn't survive his bobcat gardening, then they weren't supposed to be there.
Yes.
And I think that's a lovely ethos. And so he could make a Nyo tree look like an exquisite specimen of the highest value. Mm. Just by the way he looked after it, placed it, planted around it, thought about it, saw it.
This book is
aspirational. A lot of native grasses.
Yes, yes, and, you know, perfect for that site. This book is really aspirational as well as inspirational, isn't it?
We wanted to make some chapters of it quite practical. Malcolm was very eager that he thought people sometimes liked an environment, but they didn't know what it was about it. A home that was making them feel good. So he really pushed me to write about how you work with textures and lighting and colours and air. And that is quite practical. There are some practical chapters. And then the homes themselves, I think they are inspirational in that they make you feel, even if you just rearrange the corner of one room, you could have a little story going on. Yes, I think it is inspirational. Perhaps not aspirational. I think there's nothing terribly grand in any of those houses. There's nothing that is beyond, and I mean, a lot of decor in those homes comes from secondhand shops, to be honest.
It's just that it would you would aspire to the ethos that goes around those homes, and even if you had something very minimal like an apartment, you could bring something of the rustic into it if that's what appeals to you.
Yes, I see, exactly. I think that is absolutely correct, that there's always a way of making a home more nurturing.
Mm. We're running out of time, Kate, but I did want to talk about, you know, what an extraordinary career you have had, because you began as a journalist working with the news and in newspapers before you pivoted to creating and nurturing the, you know, the really important style. I'm trying to think of the right sort of...
Well, the funny thing was, yeah, Maureen, that the news was my first love. Being a news journalist was my calling, really. It was my vocation from when I was 8 years old. And then when I was... the features editor of the Evening Post in Wellington in the late 90s. I had two small children and I was on my own with the children, and my company offered me an opportunity to go to Auckland and edit House and Garden, and I said, I don't want to do that. I want to be the political editor of the Dominion. So they got someone else to do the job, and then a few months later I thought to myself, that was a really dumb decision, because as a young mother on my own, the political editor of the Dominion meant you were at the Houses of Parliament all night, really. And being the editor of any other newspaper meant you had to either be up at 5 o'clock in the morning or at work till 12 o'clock at night. So neither of them were very compatible with motherhood. And I thought, I should have taken that jolly job as a magazine editor, and it's a beautiful magazine. It had only been recently launched by the company. And they came back to me about 6 weeks later and said, look, would you rethink about it? I said, yes, I'd love to think about it again. I'll do it. So, and that really was a fortunate thing for me, because I loved being the editor of House and Garden. The New Zealand women were just so impressive in what they were doing in that early 2000s. It was a time when the impact of lifting the import controls that happened under the Labor government in the late 80s was really kicking in. So there was so much choice for women and how they would have their house. For the first time, really, New Zealand women had an opportunity to choose from a wide variety of imported goods, and they could express their personalities in their homes. And that was terribly exciting, and they were really doing it brilliantly. And so I was able to enjoy that period and take the magazine along with them. And so it was a wonderful period to be the editor of that magazine.
Well, you've done...
Launching Life and Leisure came in 2005. I really wanted to relaunch House and Garden with a slightly less strong focus on material possessions and more focus on experiences and what drove people to jump out of bed and do the things they do. And the company wasn't so keen on that. So I left and started my own magazine, Life and Leisure, which I then was privileged to edit. And with the brilliant Yolanta Waldendorp and the very clever Tessa Crisp, photographers like Tessa Crisp, and a wonderful stable of writers, we rode on into the wonderful 20 years of that magazine. It was a great time. But of course, magazines are very challenged these days financially, and it's very impressed with the young woman who took the magazine over, that they're keeping it going, and I wish them well.
Yes, I bet you do. Well, thank you, Kate, for all you've done to encourage and support and foster good design, as I said, and to celebrate all the people out there that are forging their own style. And the book, of course, is called New Zealand Rustic, Creating a Home Inspired by Nature. It's written by Kate Coughlan, photos by Tessa Crisp, and layout by Yolanta Waldendorp. and it's published by Ruff & Co.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
This is the third time I've spoken with Marie Connolly, who's the chair of the Readers and Writers Akaroa Festival. Very exciting that the festival is, as I say, having its third run. And you've changed the timing for this, Marie.
Yes, we've been a festival in search of a date, really, as we've tried to avoid other local festivals and various events. And we've been trying the different seasons. So, in fact, we've been doing it each 18 months. We're aiming to have it every second year in future. So this time we're going for autumn, which I think is a lovely time in Akaroa. So we're hopeful that people will come over, enjoy the scenery and everything that goes with Akaroa.
Because that's part of the whole ethos of this festival, isn't it? That
it absolutely
people
is.
Come for the weekend and do everything, you know, participate in the festival, but also explore Akaroa.
Yes, that's exactly right. And people love coming over and staying over, clearly. But at the same time, we are encouraging people to come for the day because it doesn't always suit people to come for 2 days. Our program over there is a strong 2-day program, but the days are strong in themselves. So what we're hoping for is that we will have a mix, but no matter whether you're there for 1 day or 2 days, you are there with all of our speakers. It's an intimate festival where you might find yourself sitting next to Michael Bennett and chatting to him about filmmaking, or you might sit next to Owen Marshall or Steve Bronius. And people like that about the festival, I think. Your point about bringing together a sense of community has been really, really important to us. And so we love people to come for the 2 days, and there are wonderful things to do over there. And in fact, some people come for a few more days than the 2 days, and they go off on the boats and see the dolphins and a whole range of different things. But do come for 1 day, because we've designed those days so that they are full, rich days in themselves.
A wonderful lineup of writers, I must say. Some of our most esteemed, some of our new writers, such a variety of genres that you're looking at. There's talks, there's panels, and there's workshops as well.
That's right, yes.
Let's dive into some. Oh, we can't go through everything, but if you want to pull out some highlights, Marie, for
me. Yes. Well, we've got, it's actually 3 days of festival. The Friday is starting to be our special day, if you like, where we're looking at working with the schools this time. It's a new initiative. And we really strongly believe in nurturing the next generation of writers. And so we're bringing over Gavin Bishop and Ross Kalman to work with the school children on the Friday, which is a very exciting thing for us. And they also are able to submit their work for the Rawa Flash Fiction Prize. And this year we have extended that further through sponsorship from Bailey's to include a prize for young people. So on the Friday, new initiative, very excited about that. And also we have Michael Bennett coming back for the whole day on Friday. And that's a wonderful opportunity, I think, for people to look at learning from our best, some of our best people. And Michael is, as you know, a writer of crime novels. He's a screenwriter and he produces films. And so he's doing a screenwriting piece and then he's getting people to pitch their film ideas to him. So that's a very interesting boot camp that he's talking, high energy. And I think it's going to be really terrific. And then we go into the two-day weekend of all kinds of different things, as you say, different genres, fiction, non-fiction. We've got a strength of poetry, I think, this time around. That was some feedback that we've been getting over. We've been having poetry, but we're doing a really strong push around that. And in fact, we've got an open mic.
You have.
On Friday night. Yes.
Hosted by Ray Shipley, and they are the best host you could possibly have.
That's right. Absolutely. And so we've got a whole range of people. We've got Joe Bennett. We've got Lawrence Fernley. We've got, all kinds of people.
Damien Wilkins, coming to talk about the art of fiction with Kate DeGoldy.
That's right. Tina Macariti.
Yes, short, long-listed.
Yes.
For the Occams this year.
Yes. And we're doing something a little different at the end of day one this time. Everybody's welcome to come to our crime book clubs because we've got such a strong group of crime writers. We thought, well, why don't we make something of that and give people a glass of wine, come and relax, and we'll have a little book club on their three latest books. But they'll be there this time, and it'll be the opportunity for people to talk and chat and ask questions about, in the way of a book club, really. So that's something new that we're really excited about too.
When's your book coming out, Marie?
My book's coming out in May.
Yes. So you can't...
No, just missed Rara, unfortunately. So,
well, that shows that you're not... You're not creating this festival, just...
Maybe I will in future.
Yes, I think so. Exactly.
Yes. Icefall comes out in May, and that's a sequel to
We'll look forward to that. Yeah. Yes. And this year you've got a dinner speaker at the...
We have, yes. Steve Brawnius came last time, and he's such a popular speaker. We decided this time we would have him as a dinner speaker. And so I think that'll be a terrific opportunity for people to hear him. And I have no idea what he's going to talk about. I have raised it and I think he wants it to be a surprise.
Probably a good thing.
Yes.
Because he has a very original mind. He has a very original turn of phrase. And
yes.
He has a very interesting outlook on, insight into the literary world. So,
indeed.
And this year the dinner's at the Gaiety Hall.
Yes, we've moved to the Gaiety Hall really because we have increased numbers coming. And the restaurants, we have fine restaurants right across Akaroa, but it's difficult to get the number of people that we need coming to the dinner. And so we've moved to the Gaiety. And we've got Bully Hayes providing the meals for us. And that means we've also got a bit more flexibility, I think, and a bit of a chance to move around the tables.
Brilliant. I'm going to be a little bit not personal, but I'm trying to think of it. You've got me paired up with Lawrence Fernley to talk about mountain writing. She's also talking about her novels with Jane Stafford. But there's quite, on that Sunday, there is quite a focus on people and writing and mountaineers our natural world.
Yes.
So I think that must have been very deliberate.
Yes. I mean, we have brought together quite a few local writers and people who've spent time in the Alps and have written about their experiences there. And I think that there's a real interest in that from lots of different perspectives. And Lawrence is talking about creating anthologies around mountaineering writing. And so it all started to take a nice shape, I think, on that Sunday.
Naomi Arnold's coming, her book about her walking the Te Araroa Trail is, again, it's long listed for the Ockhams. It's had a huge response from readers, hasn't it?
And it's a great book to read. It's very gripping, really, from the very beginning. It's one of those books that you want to keep on reading and wondering what's going to happen next. So she's a great writer, and I'm sure she'll have all kinds of things to tell us about those experiences as she made her way from the deep south to the top of the North Island.
You've put in, and this is a regular thing, really, sessions where you've asked writers just to talk to us rather than them being in conversation. So Tina Makariti, again, long listed for the Ockhams, her essay collection has been hugely well reviewed. Mm. So she's going to be talking about awe, the miraculous and mysterious in writing.
Yes.
And then you've got later on Kate Goldie giving a closing address. So it's really important for you, isn't it, that people have the opportunity to hear writers speak. It's really addressing, giving an address, isn't it?
We've done that from the beginning, and I think it welcomes people in, and it gives people the chance to really listen to some of the very important things that people have to say. And there are all kinds of challenges in the reading and writing space, I think. And we've got people who are deeply knowledgeable about that. And so from my point of view, I think it's important to give that space. But at the same time, they will be mingling throughout the 2 days as well. So people have the chance to talk to them and to raise questions in the two-day forum. And I think where we've got much more interactive engagement, I guess, is in the workshops, the intensives. Mm. And they've been designed for writers across a range. We have Joe Bennett, who's doing memoir, for example, and they are very much the interactive sessions. They're longer, and it means that people can really get to the center of the writing. And so I think what we've tried to do is have a real balance about the quiet space to the whole audience, and then strands to various interests, and then the workshops.
It is a very immersive festival. Mm. I've been very fortunate to have been at all of them. And it is, as you say, lovely, those chance encounters as you go to get a cup of tea somewhere, and there is Fiona Farrell or Gavin Bishop or Steve Brawnius or whatever, and you can just engage in some light conversation.
That's exactly right.
Something deep and meaningful, if you so choose.
That's right. And we have Owen Marshall is our patron, which we're always delighted to have, to welcome Owen back. And he presents the Flash Fiction Awards on the Sunday, which I think is something that is important in terms of recognizing the value of writing and our particular interest in building literary capital in our festival. And this time around, Fiona Farrell's coming as our writing ambassador. So she's going to be coming and talking and thinking to people on the ground. And I think that what we're trying to do is generate that whole sense of reading and writing as such an important, valuable experience to have. And the more people that can have that, the better.
Oh, indeed. I absolutely agree with everything you say there. So Rawa, The Readers and Writers Akaroa Festival is on from the 6th to the 8th of March. Where can people get tickets, Marie?
On our website. The Rawa website is where you get the tickets. And you can also email us through the website, and they come into my mailbox, so you'll get a reply from me.
Very personal. Thank you, Marie. I'm so looking forward to this. I have some reading and some research to do, but that is always a pleasurable thing to do. Marie Connolly is the chair of Rawa, Readers and Writers Akaroa. So please look at the program and treat yourself to a day or a weekend or even longer in Akaroa.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Pastoral Care by Tamaki Makaurau writer John Prince is the second book of short stories published in the prestigious Landfall Tauraka series. We know a little about John from the biography there. We know that he's had his stories published in Landfall and Newsroom, and that he has a master's in creative writing from Auckland University. And I think from reading the acknowledgements at the back, which are always a rich source of information, that, John, you are or have been a teacher yourself.
Yeah, I taught for 7 years. So I came to teaching a little bit later. I was maybe about 27, working in cafes in Australia, and decided to do something with my life, so to speak. And I came back to New Zealand, to Auckland, and studied, did another the teaching course there to be a secondary school teacher. And then I taught for 5 years in one school, and then moved around schools for a couple of years from there. And now I'm back at university, back studying. So I did the master's, and now I'm doing a PhD.
Brilliant. So, brilliant. Yeah. Your teaching experience forms the major part of the novella that is part of this collection. And I don't think you could have written that without being immersed in teaching in classes and teenagers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so that that story, Pastoral Care, was written in the Masters. It's a story now. What is it, about 40,000 words? But it was a novel when I handed it in for the Masters. And it began more as kind of a mystery novel. I wanted to write a kind of a murder mystery crime novel, but I don't really read crime novels, and I didn't really know how to do it. And what came out was that story and that character. And you're right. So that's hours in the classroom with teenagers. And I really love teaching. And there's a part of me that would love to keep doing it, but it's a really hard job, really demanding. The way that I do it was really demanding on my time. And now we've got two young children, it's sneaky, because it seems like it would be really flexible and great for a young family, but I found it very inflexible. So when the bell goes, you have to be there. And children don't, when you have young children, you know, they don't work to,
fit in with that time
chronology. Yeah. when they're ready, they do it. So it was quite stressful. And then there's just demands on weekend time, and I like coaching sport and that kind of thing. So this is why I've gone back to university, to kind of see how I can, I move out of the classroom, I suppose. I wasn't very ambitious as well. I didn't want to move up into senior leadership or anything like that. But I've got lots of teacher friends, and I love talking about teaching. I get a bit weepy whenever I go into a classroom, because I love that process of teaching and learning. So there's a small part of me, but it's the busy work, I think, the bureaucracy, the recording, the actual time, and yeah, and you just don't get much time to prepare lessons, and it was hard.
Do it properly.
Job.
Yeah, it is a hard job. And you know, your protagonist Paul wrestles with all those in that. I mean, you're working it out in a sense in that story,
yeah,
aren't you?
Absolutely. So I was working it out, I guess, at the time. So it was 2017, I think. I probably started that story as a murder mystery, and then got accepted into the masters at Auckland University, and our first son was born around that time, so 2018, and what started to kind of take my attention and agitate me and did the thing that writers do, kind of dealing with the most difficult things, was being a new father and kind of that pull between work and family and the domestic and the public. And so that's what was kind of on my mind. But then, I mean, I started writing that, and then, like I say, it was a novel out at probably 80,000 words, and then it's been trimmed back down. There's all these other scenes that have been written around it. I have the funeral scene for the actor character, so Louise and Owen Durham. I've got a lot of their lives written out that never made it. So the I don't know, in academics we talk about the fabula, which is the world of the story, which I've heard described as a ball of wool, which is a really great way to describe a ball of wool. And then what you do when you write a story is you pluck one of the threads of wool out and you tell that version. And so I feel like that ball of wool for the pastoral care, for the bigger story, is a really fully formed, colourful, big ball of wool that I was lucky enough to write over all those years. Yeah.
So your writing started very early on. Have you been, you know, testing yourself out as a short story writer, as a novel writer, just seeing where it took you and filling in those gaps in cafes and studying?
Yeah, definitely. I wrote some reviews in Australia for like a street press. And I didn't really enjoy writing reviews, having an opinion on, I think I had to write one on Tim Finn's new album or something, and I felt really uncomfortable about that, having an opinion. But in saying that, I'm writing a review at the moment for the Aotearoa review of books, the online site. But maybe we can talk about that later. But yeah, I have always been writing. I had a full novel, I reckon, in about 2017-18, a totally different story, and I was sending it off, getting rejected. Ashley Young won't know this, but I messaged her back when it was Twitter, and it was her memoir collection, Can You Tolerate This, was out, and I messaged her directly saying, what do I do to get published? How can I get an editor? What did you do? And New Zealand, Aotearoa, have to love it. She messaged me back saying, my advice is to go and do a master's at a university writing course where you're in a room with 12 other people and you get to workshop your work. It's a really good way, she said. And at that same time, Emma Neal published A Good Man in Landfall. And all I'd wanted to do was to be published in Landfall. That was my goal. I just wanted a short story in Landfall. And that happened at the same time that Paula Morris accepted me into her master's course. So it all happens in a flood, and it all happened to me. And that's kind of how things seem to happen to me. Kind of it all came flooding in, and I was suddenly kind of doing this master's course, had a story in Landfall. And yeah, so writing, it has, it's a compulsion. I don't know how to, describe it any other way. I would do it. And I had done it. All the writing that I had done for pastoral care was done with an intention to be published. But in my mind, I never quite believed it would be true, that it would become so I was writing for an audience of myself sort of thing. I don't really share much of my work. And so, yeah, I was quite free and open and really honest and allowed that kind of that thing that happens when you're creating art, that kind of unconscious kind of feelings to bubble up and be expressed onto the page. Some of them are kind of embarrassing. Some of them are, kind of making me a bit uncomfortable. There's a certain amount of unease to be published and to have some of the stories in the world. But it's the work is as true as I think I could make it.
There, I'm trying to generalize, which is really an awful thing to do when you've got distinct stories, distinct characters. But on the whole, there are female protagonists there. But what comes through, I suppose, after you've read them, is men wrestling with who they are, where they fit, what their role is. In various situations. One of the stories that impacted on me, and I'm not quite sure why, was The Falls, which is set out at Piha, where a man is in his old family badge. The history goes back a long way in the area, and he's wanting to sell it. His brother, who's a very successful person living overseas, wants to maintain it. And it's very dark. It's when you describe, and I don't think this is a spoiler, the fire that eventually makes the decision, really. It just stayed with me, that your writing where it was, the bush around it, the fire taking hold, how he was coping with it or not coping with it, really. And that's quite a common for me in reading your stories. It was quite a common reaction to be taken right into the story and become part of it.
Yeah, great. Thank you. That's really lovely to hear. The fire particularly, a lot of crafting. That was a part of a really early draft of the main pastoral care story. So those two characters will be conflated a little bit. So it was an off cut. It wasn't working. He went to Piha. It wasn't working. So that got cut out. And then later on, I returned to it because I really loved the atmosphere of the fire. And I think Piha is a place. There's a special kind of atmosphere that I think you're picking up on the darkness. There's a heaviness around that. And I went out and I surfed. So I was going out to Piha and surfing there a lot. And I went out and stayed out there for a few nights. I walked up to the falls themselves with a notepad and spent hours sitting there just writing down, describing what I can hear and what I can feel and doing the work for that particular scene and that story. And I guess I was probably thinking about I've got a brother who lives in Melbourne. And there was that story. I struggled for a long time how to end that story, whether it be about kind of a more kind of colonial, like what nationalistic thing, or a more personal, private, brotherly, human thing. And I think I went for the human. I always try and go for the human. The relationships, I think the relationships are at the centre of most of the stories that I write. It's the thing I think about the most. And I think it's the most interesting thing. The fiction dealing with relationships is when it kind of takes off for me.
You've also got a literary figure in there, Bernard Jane, who's a poet, and he turns up. There's a story about him, but he also turns up in pastoral care where the teacher Paul, uses his work in the class. Is that an opportunity for you to necessarily express your own views about the literary world, but try out some notions about how literary figures work?
Maybe. I don't know. He's fun. He was a fun character to play with. Maybe I'm secretly a poet and it's a chance for me to write some poetry. There are a lot. Bernard Jane has written a lot more poems than are in the book.
I bet.
And it was, so Emma Neal was editing this book with me, and we had some really funny conversations. Well, her sort of emails about Bernard Jane's his kind of claims to greatness and whether the poems were actually standing up to
any good at all.
His reputation. Yeah. So yeah, it's more just it's fun and it's playful. He's a really playful. I've got stories where he loses his child. Like he's got a friend around and he's having drinks and the child he loses him, and there's so him and with the actor character between the two of them, they kind of maybe serve some kind of old representation, I guess, of the literary kind of scene in New Zealand. I as part of my PhD proposal, I was reading and had been thinking about all the stories in Landfall. So I wanted to read back to 1947 and chart the narrative structures of the short stories up until now. And then I realised structuralism is really out of fashion, an old hat, so no one really wanted to deal with that. And I've moved on from the Landfall stories, but what reading all those stories gave me is a sense of history and where kind of the short story in New Zealand has kind of how it's moved and been shaped by different forces.
It's always been very important, and I think we've got some remarkable short story writers.
Yeah, I just love the short story. I love the mechanics, the intensity of a short story. I like, the machinery of it is the thing that I love. I love writing it. Although I'm really enjoying kind of, I really enjoyed kind of writing the longer story. I think I heard Claire Keegan talking about her story. I really admire her writing and her stories kind of taking as long as they need. And I think there isn't a place often for longer stories in New Zealand literature. Often the competitions are 4,000, 3,000 words cut off, and it's not much time to get kind of into a character or to move. It limits the narrative. I think Te Heringa Waka Press released a long distance, I think it was called.
I remember that, yes. Recently. Yeah, and Elizabeth Smither has just put out four novellas. Collection. I agree. A story should be as long as it takes.
Yeah. You never quite know. And sometimes, often what I will do is write past the story and then come back. So this listener story that I've recently wrote, 1,200 words, I think it was, which is for me a really that's a very limiting number. But I mean, but writers can do it. It's just my instincts aren't for that kind of brevity. On my I was thinking about and coming to talk to you the master's course and the people sitting in the room. In that course, it was 2019 through 2020, so it was right in that COVID era. And we had Melanie Dixon was in there, who you spoke to, or Marianne spoke to.
Oh, she's a neighbour of mine.
Yeah. Oh, is she? Yeah, right,
yeah,
great.
Yeah. Well.
So her, Jack Ramel Cottrell, who writes the flash fiction. I know Melanie writes that flash short fiction as well. Shelley Byrne Field, who's writing for young adults, Kahu and Kikino, and writes amazing short stories as well, really moving short stories, I think. There's others, but I'm forgetting. But there was, in the room, there's just these people who've gone on to publish this really great work.
Well, let's finish with what it means to you to be the second volume of this really prestigious Landfall series.
Yeah, so much. So I, as part of this PhD study I'm doing, I'm reading Rain by Kirsty Gunn, and her being the first to publish under the Tauraka short story series. I mean, to have her name in the same conversation as my name just kind of blows my mind. Rain, to me, is an absolute masterpiece, and I've been reading it now for a year, and it still brings me to tears. There's still moments, and I'm still learning from it. And her collection, Pretty Ugly, which I reviewed as well, was really amazing. Her work is, and I have to thank you for this, because you described it as atmospheric. And I heard your interview with her a while ago and didn't occur. And then I re-listened to it and you said it was atmospheric, and I had taken that and incorporated it into my studies. So I'm really grateful for that. I'm Sue Whitten at Otago University Press, and her team, Mal, Meg, Rebecca, Fiona, the designer, are just amazing to work with. Everything seemed really easy, and I felt really safe, in really safe hands. To have Gavin Hipkins's work, Bluefield, on the cover, I know that Sue really wanted New Zealand art and as part of this series, he came to the launch and we had a great chat, and he's a really interesting, his own work is really interesting to think about. As a debut writer, it's so hard to get published in this small little world of writing in New Zealand. And it's like, when did I say, it's 2016, 17, like you work on this for a long, long time and there's so many rejections, and I wasn't quite sure if short stories were ever going to be able to be published as a debut writer, which is why I was stretching out the story to a novel, because I thought I had more chance. And you send your work, or I was sending my work to competitions because that seemed like the only way. And that in itself adds a whole other feeling and emotion when you're competing against your peers. And so, it's amazing. I feel very, very grateful.
Good. Well, thank you, John. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, and I am in awe of your writing. I think we will see a lot more of John Prince's work. This book is called Pastoral Care. It is by John Prince and it's published by Otago University Press. And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.